Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Jorge Mario Bergoglio, also known as Pope Francis, has been head of the world's 1.2 billion Catholics for less than a year. But in that short time, he's caused quite a stir. His statements about gay men and women, women in general, capitalism, and much more mark a major shift from his predecessor and have made Pope Francis, even by the standards of a pontiff, a bit of a celebrity. James Carroll's article titled, Who Am I to Judge?, appears in the most recent issue of The New Yorker, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Happy New Year.
Thank you so much, Elliot. Glad to be with you.
The title of the article, Who Am I to Judge?, I think my reaction was the same as everybody else's when he first said that. It's like, you're the Pope. It's your job to judge. It's your job to judge people, right?
It's true. It's a, it's a brilliant bit of rhetorical flourish, isn't it? Since judgmentalism has seemed to define the office ever since we heard of it, and so for a pope to step aside from the function of judging other people, judging them from a position of moral superiority, it seemed quite shocking. And that what's interesting is, of course, it was not an isolated flourish. It turns out that this man has, in any number of large and important ways, stepped away from the old kind of imperial role of the papacy.
And just so we remember, the actual incident in which he said, who am I to judge, who was he talking to and about?
He was on an airplane coming back from World Youth Day in Brazil, speaking informally with reporters, one of whom asked him about the place of gay clergy in the Catholic Church. So it was a question expressly about his attitude toward gay priests. And that's one of the things that made it a very striking statement. Who am I to judge? And he goes on to suggest the sort of human complications of people who find themselves in conflict with the institution of the Church. And it was a clear signal that he was not going to continue the kind of judgmental rejectionism toward gay people, which, you know, frankly, is a hugely important issue because, after all, think of all those young men and women, adolescents, who are weighed down by a world of judgment, a world of people telling them they're unworthy, they're bad, they're wicked. We know, alas, that one of the leading causes of the deaths of young people is suicide, and we know that of suicide young people, many of them are struggling with issues of sexual identity and being made to feel condemned for it. So it's a rejection of judgmentalism that has profound implications for people.
But it's a big leap to not judge to get to the point where a pope would actually stand up and embrace same-sex marriage, for example.
Well, it's a very important point because Pope Francis is no liberal in the culture wars. He's asserted in any number of ways that he continues to hold the basic traditional positions of Catholic moral teaching. But what he's done, I believe, is something more significant, which is a suggestion that the attitude toward that you take toward moral questions is more important in a way than the strictures or the rules by which you define those questions. He was pressed in a later interview about his attitude toward gay people. Obviously, a lot of conservatives were pushing back on his apparent open-mindedness. And his answer was even more illuminating. He said, I've been asked to elaborate on my opinion toward gay people, and I answer with a question. When God sees a gay person, what does God see? Someone to be condemned and rejected and despised? Or does God see a person whom God loves? That's the ground on which Pope Francis is standing, that there's a basic condition of acceptance toward every person that has to carry much more weight than rejection based on readings of sinfulness.
Do you think that he's actually going to change the church teachings that call homosexuality a sin?
In a way, it doesn't matter what his purpose at this moment is, but because by interjecting this broader notion of acceptance of refusal to condemn, inevitably church teaching will be affected by it. If every human being stands equally, shoulder to shoulder with every other human being, each one having a right to be taken seriously on his or her own terms, that inevitably is going to change the way we define the morality of behavior. So there's something much more basic at work in Pope Francis than a simple rewriting of the rules. He's basically asking us to reconsider where the rules come from and what they're for. This is a very biblical, not just gospel, but biblical orientation. When in Exodus, when God introduces himself to Moses, he says, what drew my attention to the people was not their sin, it was their suffering. When Pope Francis looks out across the world, he doesn't see sinful people, which is frankly the note that's most often been struck by the Vatican. The Vatican has defined its relationship to the world as a kind of moral guardian against a sinful world. Now, this Pope is very different from that. When he looks out across the world, he sees people who are beloved by God, and those who stand out most among those people are the suffering poor. It's not a rhetorical flourish, again, that he has put the poor at the center of his preoccupation as Pope. He doesn't look at people and see what they're doing wrong. He looks at people and sees what they need to live more happy and fulfilled lives.
We often try to paint people, or at least try to pigeonhole people politically, and you write pretty clearly that he's not a liberal.
No, he's not a liberal.
How would you describe him?
Well, I would. You know, the word that has come to mind from a number of points of view for me is radical, that he actually pushes deeper into questions than the old left-right conversation usually takes us. An example of that is his whole attitude toward women in the church. He's reiterated Pope John Paul and Pope Benedict's rejection of women for the priesthood in the Catholic Church, for example. He said that door is closed. And yet he has said that the way in which power is exercised in the church has to be much more inclusive. He hasn't used the word democratic, but he's definitely moving the governing structure of the church toward a more democratic polity. And when you begin to move the exercise of power in that direction, one inevitable consequence is going to be the elevation of the power of women. And I believe he set in motion a kind of political transformation of the church that will inevitably lead to the fuller equality of women, both inside the church and in the church's attitude toward women in the world more generally.
I was surprised to find out that technically women can be cardinals.
It's a little bizarre, isn't it? What you're referring to is that there were rumors last month that the Pope was going to name several women to the College of Cardinals in February. One of them, Mary McAleese, the former president of Ireland, whom I interviewed for the New Yorker article, was quick to step aside from that question. She's not looking to become a cardinal. But that's a signal. You know, when people in power in the church begin to talk about naming women to the College of Cardinals, what they're looking for are ways around the bind the church has created for itself by claiming theological rationales for the exclusion of women from the priesthood. There is no theological rationale for the exclusion of women from the College of Cardinals. You could say there's a massive cultural rationale for it.
And a history. What would happen to the average Catholic? What would they think about that if that happened?
Well, I think actually one of the ironies is that if a woman were named to the College of Cardinals, you'd quickly have to confront the anachronism of this institution. It's, after all, the College of Cardinals they're a court of princes. And it's a cultural structure that has its roots in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. It's a throwback. And the thing that allows it to continue with the regalia, the the dress, the life apart, the princeliness of it. The thing that allows it to continue is the way in which nothing mundane is allowed to intrude. Well, nothing more mundane could intrude than the appointment of women to it. What would they wear, for goodness sake? These men are garbed in robes. They're garbed in the costumes of a Renaissance court. It's very easy to imagine a woman, Mary McAleese, or any other distinguished woman. She would have to be quite distinguished to be appointed, effectively repudiating the culture of the regalia, of the status, much in the way that Pope Francis has begun to repudiate the culture, the regalia, the status of the papacy itself. So what we have underway here, in other words, is a long overdue cultural transformation of the governing structure of the church.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is James Carroll. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe, and he's written an article in the most recent New Yorker called "Who Am I to Judge a Radical Pope's First Year?" The Daily News had reported on Tuesday that some wealthy donors were balking at giving more financial support to the restoration of St. Patrick's following the new pope's criticism of the wealthy and inequality. What exactly did Pope Francis say?
Well, Pope Francis has made a number of statements about the importance of taking seriously the plight of poor people. And he's moved in ways that he's in charge of. He's moved, he's pulled the levers of the Vatican to change the way its relationship to wealth is unfolding. He's rejected the symbol of this is extremely powerful. He's rejected life in the Apostolic Palace to live in a simple two-room apartment in effectively the Vatican Hospice, a small, modest hotel in Vatican City. He lives in a two-room apartment there, which is unthinkable given the princely history of popes down through the centuries. And he's criticized the lifestyles of many Catholic prelates. He repudiated the lifestyle choices of a particular high-living German bishop a couple of months ago, for example. He's put the question very directly to every Catholic bishop and every Catholic cardinal: how are you living? What do people see when they see you? And what is the church for? And what side of the great rich-poor divide that is such a problem for the world today, what side is the church on? And the Pope has, without actually attacking anybody and without being particularly critical toward individuals, he's put that question very powerfully, not just to bishops and clergy, but to every Catholic, and I would say broadly, to every person. He's drawing our attention to a very basic question of right and wrong. The fact that millions of people on the planet today do not have enough to live decently has to stop being a matter of indifference. We have to start seeing it. The Pope sees it, and he's making other people see it.
It's interesting how even seemingly the mundane, he takes that in his own life. You write about not only did he not get the new ring that theoretically comes with every new pope, he didn't want the dishes.
That's a particularly amusing detail, Elliot. It's and a kind of tragic one. Beginning in the late 19th century, a high-end Roman porcelain manufacturer has been supplying dishes to popes. And it has its roots, ironically and tragically enough, in the Roman ghetto, where popes effectively imprisoned the Jewish population of Rome for centuries. And when the ghetto was liberated, a particular Jewish family wanted to express a debt of gratitude to the papacy and began to supply these dishes. That's the origin of the tradition, the Limentani family, quite a wonderful Roman family. And they made a set of dishes for as recently as for Pope Benedict. And when I spoke to the proprietor of the Limentani shop last month, he told me that no, they had no request for dishes from Pope Francis, and they didn't expect to get one. He was the person who said, the Pope hasn't bought a new ring. Why should he get a new set of dishes?
It also seems that the new Pope has distributed a bit of a Vatican questionnaire about divorce and birth control, unmarried people living together, gay marriage. Who got the poll?
Well, there that goes to the question I was raising before about his radical character, if he's actually bringing about a shift in the way power is exercised in the church. And the largest signal of that is that he has elevated an upcoming, already scheduled, but upcoming synod of bishops, a gathering, a representative body of bishops coming in 2014, later this year. And in preparation for it, this is the innovation, the Pope has ordered every bishop to conduct a serious grassroots campaign of gathering information from lay Catholic men and women about their real experience. The theme of the synod is family life, what their real experience of family life is. And to everyone's surprise, the Vatican itself, under Pope Francis's express order, distributed through the bishops to the parishes, to the lay people, an elaborate questionnaire asking people to express what their actual experience is of gay marriage. Are you a gay person? Do you know gay people who are married? Of contraception, the question of people living together who are not married, a range of issues having to do with family life, each one of which touches on rules and regulations that the church has been claiming for a long time cannot be changed. Contraception, divorce and remarriage, gay marriage, rules and issues that the church cannot change. Hello, why would you ask for input on questions that can't be changed? And that's one of the largest signals of a shift underway already. So that gathering of information is underway now. The bishops are going to be taking it into account. My strong hope and maybe even prediction is that that synod will include representatives of lay men and women, Catholic people, family life experts, if you will. I quoted Mary McAleese, the former president of Ireland, as saying, please let us not have a gathering of bishops telling us who live in families what our needs are, men who do not have experience themselves of family life, telling the rest of us what family life is supposed to be. This synod is going to be different, and that questionnaire is a powerful symbol of it.
The new pope seems to be pretty popular, even with non-Catholics. What do you think is driving this phenomenon?
It's astonishing, actually. It's not a surprise to me that Catholics are enthralled with this man. He represents such a breath of fresh air for us. But his impact on the world is really striking. Time magazine's Man of the Year, I noted a couple of days ago that Esquire named him the best-dressed man of 2013, simple wardrobe choices. But it clearly has a man has captured the imagination of human beings all over the planet. Why? I don't know why. One of the things that occurs to me is that he does, in some inchoate way, represent an ancient human longing for symbols, signals, signs of the mysterious experience we all have of life on this planet. What are we doing here? You know, the great old questions that we've long since forgotten how to ask, much less answer. He's a representative of transcendent longing just by the office he holds. And the great relief people feel is that a man worthy of that tradition and humble before it is in front of us, and it's an astonishing experience to see this unfold.
One of the things Pope Francis has not talked a lot about is sexual abuse of children by priests. I want to ask you about that in just a moment. I'm speaking with New Yorker contributor James Carroll about his profile of Pope Francis. It's called Who Am I to Judge?, which appeared in the December 23rd issue of the magazine. We'll be back with more right after a break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Today, my guest is James Carroll. His article, Who Am I to Judge?, is in the most recent issue of The New Yorker. James is also a columnist for the Boston Globe. What are your thoughts on the fact that the Pope Francis has been a little quiet on the issue of sexual abuse of children by priests? I believe he set up a commission. Where does that issue stand now with this pope?
It's a disappointment, would be the first thing I'd say. It's a good example of the fact that we're not, when we're talking about Pope Francis, for all of the kind of wonders of his arrival on the scene, we're not talking about somebody who's exempt from the problems the church is burdened by. Let's step back and remember here that the Catholic Church is in a state of collapse. The moral authority of the church has been shaken, unlike even beyond the ways in which it was shaken, I would say, during the Reformation. The fact that thousands of Catholic priests over the decades have abused, raped, betrayed in multiple ways, tens of thousands of Catholic children, is an astonishment. It's a moral collapse that we have yet to reckon with. And it's complicated further by the fact that though there were thousands of Catholic priests guilty of such crimes, they were still a minority of the priesthood. But the vast majority of bishops protected the priests instead of the children. And that moral failure defines the crisis that Francis is confronted with as pope. And, of course, he is the pope only because his predecessor, Pope Benedict, resigned. And it's very clear to me that the resignation of Pope Benedict was conditioned on this terrible crisis that is wreaking such havoc in the lives of so many people. So given that, what has Pope Francis's response been? Well, it's been all too little. He did, as you say, appoint a commission last month to protect children and to respond to the needs of victims. There's nothing in the establishment of that commission that goes to one of the large unfinished pieces of business, which is to hold bishops accountable for their cover-up and for their enabling of predators.
What would be the reforms you would hope would come out of this?
Every bishop in the world needs to make fully transparent the list of priests in his charge who've been accused and the disposition of the accusations. There are still many predator priests who have not been held to account, and their cases are still held in secrecy by many bishops. The Pope could begin by making much more public, making public at all, the history of abuse of children by priests in Argentina, where he was Cardinal of Buenos Aires. He could come forward and show the records of his own diocese there.
Was it as big a deal in Latin America as it was in Europe and in the United States?
Well, the story of priestly abuse of children in Latin America is not well known yet. That one would have to be naive to assume that it hasn't been happening in Latin America. That's actually, you know, in the early days of this crisis, people in Rome especially said, oh, well, that's just happening in secular, too liberal America. Well, the next thing you know, the scandal had swept across the Atlantic into Ireland, Belgium, Austria, these traditional Catholic countries. Throughout Europe, the scandal has been laid bare, and one can assume that there's a scandalous behavior of priests to be laid bare in Latin America. Just because that hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that children haven't been abused. This is a cultural phenomenon that transcends national boundaries, and priests have been getting away with this kind of criminal behavior for generations now, the church is far from finished with it, far from finished with it. And Pope Francis has a long way to go. He hasn't met personally with victims. He has to do that. He has to put firmer structures of responsibility on bishops, as I said. And you know, when you talk about the synod considering family life, Nowhere in that questionnaire we talked about a minute ago is the question asked, what has been the effect on family life of the betrayal of children by priests and by bishops? What has that done to Catholic families? And how do we get healed from that? This is a problem that is far from finished. And
you're right.
I do believe the Pope knows it, and I'm expecting the Pope to deal with it much more forthrightly.
You also give us a little more background of his history while in Argentina. He lived through a lot of the dirty war that was going on in Argentina, and you tell the story of Pope Francis's then mentor, a woman, and her daughter. Tell us about that.
Well, a woman who was his first boss when he was a teenager, employed in a chemical laboratory, whom he identifies as a communist, and whom he said he loved as a young man. She was his mentor, his caretaker, and during the years of the dirty war, as a woman associated with communists, she came under pressure herself from the junta. First, her daughter was arrested, and she became active in the Mothers of the Disappeared. She became threatened. She turned to Bergoglio, Archbishop Bergoglio, for help. He helped her. He went to her place and quietly took away the books that she was afraid would incriminate her. He put them in a Jesuit library. Ultimately, her daughter was released, but she refused to leave Argentina and continued to work for the disappeared. And sure enough, she was herself arrested. She disappeared. She was thrown from a helicopter like thousands of others. When her body washed up, Bergoglio saw to its being buried in the garden of the church where she'd been arrested. That's the beginning of his own personal trauma in that story, but the trauma continued as he got drawn into a conflict with some of his own Jesuit confreres, priests who were heavily engaged in working with the poor in Buenos Aires, and who were associated with so-called liberation theology, which was a liberal theological political movement in the church that was looked on askance by Rome and that Bergoglio himself was suspicious of. And he ordered these priests to leave their work in the slums of Buenos Aires, which they refused to do. And in the thick of that authority conflict, which he himself now is quite critical of and describes quite forthrightly, in the thick of that conflict, the two priests were arrested by the junta. They disappeared. And it's debated to this day what actually happened. The priests, apparently at the time, believed that Bergoglio had reported them to the authorities, had betrayed them. Bergoglio denies that and insists that he went to work immediately for their release. And there are plenty of reasons to believe that. It's very clear that Bergoglio was traumatized by this experience. The priests eventually were released, having been severely tortured. One of them wrote a book in which he claimed that Bergoglio betrayed them. But the other, after Bergoglio was elected, Pope Francis was explicit in saying Bergoglio had not done that. So here's a man who was caught in the middle of a terrible political crisis. He did not behave as he wishes now that he would have.
Right.
And he acknowledges this as one of the conditions of what changed him.
We've only got a few seconds left. You start your article by talking about the fact that you had studied to be in the priesthood and then you stopped. I'm just wondering that if this pope had been around at that time period, might you have made a different decision?
Well, I was fully engaged in the Catholic reform generated by Pope John the 23rd. I was one of those young priests who was absolutely energized by the Second Vatican Council. And when the church began to roll it back and to turn away from its promise, I, like so many of my generation, turned away from the priesthood.
Thank you. I'm going to have to cut you there, James. Thank you so much. His article is Who Am I to Judge in the New Yorker. James Carroll, thanks for joining me.
You're most welcome. I appreciate it.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Bye-bye.